All right, so my name's Peter Ladotti, and we're going to do, the next session is going to be all about RESTful WCF programming. So good job, Miguel, this morning for getting us a really good fundamental understanding of service-oriented architecture and WCF and how you use all the different components. And there's a lot of good stuff that Miguel told you guys about. I'm going to tell you guys about some different stuff, and I'm probably going to poke fun at all the stuff he told you about and how complex it is, and maybe more complex than it needs to be. So we'll poke fun with that. Just a little bit for folks who don't know me, I am the local Microsoft developer evangelist for the New York area. There have been a lot of questions today about the content and the recordings. So this meeting is being recorded. All the sessions are streaming online, and the PowerPoint and the demo code will be made available, but it's going to take at least 2 to 3 weeks before the videos are processed and published on Channel 9. But when they are, the one URL to remember is my blog at peterladotti.com. That's where we will publish the links to all the stuff, the content, the videos, the code, all that type of good stuff. So something to know about there. And you can see on the side there, I host a podcast. If you're interested in that, check that out at connectedshow.com.
In the interest of not making them wait that long, are we authorized to post our sessions on our own blogs in order to get it to them?
We can coordinate that afterwards. I don't know yet, so okay. We'll work that out.
Because I personally would hate to wait 3 weeks for something like that. So
yeah, I would too, but I don't want to overpromise, underdeliver. I want to do the other way around.
Well, I'm asking permission because I know this is all coordinated by Microsoft.
We'll figure that out. All right, so REST. Anyone here know what REST is?
Yeah.
Hopefully that's what we're all doing now. Everyone here in New York with pizza in their bellies. Hopefully the food coma is not going to set in, and you know, we'll be able to keep moving along here without putting everyone to sleep. At least I'll try to be more active. But that's not the REST I'm talking about. Although on a hot day like today, that's probably where I'd like to be sitting right now, is on the hammock in my backyard, taking in the sun. Pretty close to where I live, yeah. But I don't live right on it, but because I'm a Jersey Shore Dev guy. That's my name. There you go. So REST is an acronym. It stands for Representational State Transfer. It's a whole way of describing how you do programming using traditional web APIs under the covers. And it's a different way of doing web services versus the traditional model that you've been learning about all morning, that even though we're using the WCF as an API within the .NET framework, we're really talking about doing SOAP and WSDL type communication over the wire, using all the WS star specifications to wrap up security and all these other protocols on top of the messages we send over the wire. With REST, we're really breaking it down and making it more simple and keeping what goes over the wire using the plain old basics of the web from the old days. So let's talk about why REST is important. Let me ask a question. How many folks here know what REST is or have heard of it, have an idea? Okay, so about half the room. Guessing the other half, maybe some people have heard and they just don't want to talk about it. But REST is pretty important. And a key thing is it's not new. I mean, it's relatively new and becoming one of these buzzwords that you hear about all the time when you read the blogs and all that type of stuff. But REST is really a new word to describe an old technology. But there are a lot of services out there that are using REST today on the internet. So Microsoft services are using it, like on Windows Live when you interact with us. You're going to learn later on in the day from Don about ADO.NET Data Services, which is really now, I believe, WCF Data Services. It was renamed with .NET 4.0. SQL Server Data Services, and pretty much everyone else who's not Microsoft is using REST. So if you want to go out and talk to third-party web APIs like Yahoo or Flickr or Twitter or any of these types of sites that a lot of people are talking to in the Web 2.0 world, all these sites are exposing their APIs as RESTful endpoints. Some of them are using SOAP and WSDL, in which case you can use WCF the way you're used to using it, but a lot of them are using REST. And there's a lot of reasons for that, which I'm going to talk about it. But another reason is that Microsoft is going full-on betting in using REST itself. So if you learn about our new cloud computing platform, Windows Azure, and all the different services it offers within the App Fabric and data and all that type of good stuff. Got a ringing phone here. How about that?
So, about
that? Yeah, I know. Something about that. No ringing phones. I should silence mine. Anyway, all of the Azure services expose themselves via RESTful APIs. So this is something that Microsoft's committed to in terms of implementing our own services this way. And therefore, when you consume them or produce your own, you want to have the ability to do that. So WCF, when it first came out in 2006, version 1, didn't support REST. But the beauty of WCF was that it was designed as an extensible architecture. Guys like Don Box did some of the original design work on it, made it extensible so you could add new types of endpoints, new types of transports and protocols and channels to plug into it. And it works out that to implement RESTful services, it's not that hard to modify WCF. So when the next version of WCF came out, which was part of .NET 3.5, we added REST to it. So it was really easy to do. So let's talk a little bit about REST itself. Where did this name come from? Well, it turns out it came from this term paper by a guy named Dr. Roy Fielding. This was back in, I think, 2001-ish or so. And he wrote a whole paper about basically describing the notion of exposing APIs using traditional web protocols. And this is what I really like to call just giving something old a new name. So what does that mean, using traditional web protocols? Well, I should say before that, really talking about embracing everything the web has to offer, everything that made the web what it is and so popular as a unique format for sharing data that we can browse amongst in a browser. Whereas this generic client, you issue URLs into it, or really we should say URIs, universal resource indicators, meaning it's a resource, represents anything, not necessarily a page, but something, it's a resource that we want to access. That could be a piece of functionality, an API, you know, it could be, you know, a file, you know, an image to bring it in, or an audio file or something like that. It was just a great way of how things work just by uniquely addressing something with an address out there. HTML, obviously, is what makes the web really popular because it's easy through markup language to define a user interface, and that's become an accepted standard that everyone uses all over the place. But being able to connect and link back and forth through the notion of hyperlinks, that's obviously a core tenet of the web, is that everything can be linkable or connected to from everywhere else. There's no control, there's no contracts or boundaries, things just work. And to that degree, HTTP, which is our protocol for going over the wire for the web, supports different types of actions, or we can call them verbs. One of those is the GET request. And that is the most basic and fundamental use case on the web. Anytime you go to your browser and you type something like CNN.com and hit the enter key, you are issuing an HTTP GET request to that server, which is then going to serve you back some content or some information. Now, 9 times out of 10 in a web browser, it's serving back straight up HTML that's human readable, you know, meant for end user consumption. But there's nothing saying that when you issue that GET request, it couldn't send you back some data that you handle programmatically in code on a client that's going to interact with it as though it were a service. And when we're talking about RESTful programming, that's what we're doing at the end of the day. We're going to rely fundamentally on just sending the bare minimum amount of data back and forth over HTTP. Now, REST itself, it's not a product, it's not an API, it's not a library, it's not even a specification. It's literally just a style of programming. And that being said, since it's not a standard or a specification, the term can be overloaded. Different folks can say, oh yeah, I'm doing RESTful programming, and other folks might say, no, you're not. You're not following the rules to a T. And, you know, there's some mixed opinions on it out there in terms of what's RESTful and what's not, and I'll talk more about that as we go along. But the key thing is it's not some sort of specification or API. It's just a style. And it really, you know, if you look at Dr. Felding's paper, there's a bunch of tenets that come along with it, which are pretty much the things we just talked about. The web is a set of linked resources that we can get back and forth to. Resources are identified by URIs. These are things I want to be able to access, units of functionality, units of data, all that type of good stuff. Resources that we expose can support a fixed set of operations, meaning, you know, I can't just go bonkers. You know, if I define, you know, if you're going to call this URL and it's going to give you a certain behavior, you should expect to get that behavior every time. It shouldn't do different things when you issue that same resource from a different point in time. And these are defined by the HTTP verbs that we can call. And applications follow links to achieve late binding. And that's how a web browser works, because you're not bound to go to different websites. You just issue a URL whenever you want. You go where you need to go. So from a programming aspect, and this is similar to the stuff you've been hearing about all day today with service-oriented architecture, everything's loosely coupled. That's the whole point of it, is that there, you know, it's late binding just based on contracts that you share back and forth. But in REST, we're just saying, look, it's so simple you don't even need the contract anymore. Now, that might be good or bad depending on your scenario, but, you know, we'll look at that. It's really, like I said, just a whole way of, you know, building things. It's a whole style, whole principle, and it just embraces the web. All right, so let's talk about embracing the web. This is a little bit of a history lesson, in my opinion. So if you go back to when the web started out, you know, in the early 90s, we were all learning about this whole HTTP thing in the web, how we do HTTP calls back and forth over the wire. And we have HTTP verbs. So the GET request, or the GET verb, is the one we all know about, because that's what we use in the browser most often. The other one that's probably we're all pretty familiar with is the POST operation. So anytime you do a request to a web server and you send it a bunch of data, you can wrap it in what's known as a form, and it gets posted up to the server. It's part of a request that goes up. And when you do a GET request, think to when we're just doing simple web programming with ASP.NET or something like that, you pass all your data on the query string, which is part of the URL. Just you append, you know, name equals value pairs to the end of the query string, and that gets passed up. And the user in the browser can see all that. When you do a POST, you're actually wrapping it up, and you can specify a content type that you're pushing the data up, and it goes up to the server. But it's kind of obscured from the end user. They don't see that in the browser address bar. But it's there behind the scenes, and it's definitely sniffable. You can look at that and peek at that using some of the sniffing tools, which we're going to show. But there's a bunch of other verbs, put, delete, and other things. There's probably about 10 other ones. These are the most common ones that would map naturally to the typical operations we would think when we work with data, which are the CRUD operations, create, read, update, and delete. Now, those other verbs are not usually supported by the web browsers, at least natively. I mean, you can't issue a put request or delete request from the address bar in your browser. You can do it programmatically via something like JavaScript when you're doing Ajax-style programming. And when we're doing RESTful-style programming, that's typically how the client will be. In most cases, it typically ends up being a JavaScript-oriented client. It could be a .NET client, could be C#, VB code that's issuing using some of the web request APIs in the framework. But typically, that's where most of these things are coming from. Any questions so far? Everyone's quiet as that pizza settles in, right? Knew that would have to happen. So let's explore HTTP a little further. You know, so we have these verbs. They're the basic types of requests that we could send back and forth over the wire. These are all things that have been in the web since the beginning, you know. And if you're doing web programming with ASP.NET, you can get access to the context object, HTTP context, and you can explore all these things that come across the wire. And 9 times out of 10 in .NET, we've been able to ignore all this stuff because it's obscured, you know, or abstracted away by the tools. And we didn't have to care about it, and we don't always have to. But when we're doing RESTful programming, these things are important. We pay attention to what's going over the wire. So, for example, content type. You set the MIME type. You set what it is. Am I sending or receiving XML? Am I sending or receiving HTML? Am I sending or receiving JSON over the wire? You know, am I sending a zap file over the wire if it's a Silverlight app or something like that? Those are all things that get specified in the root HTTP transaction or messaging that goes over the wire. Things like authorization, you know, we set that up in a cookie and we send that back and forth over the wire. Whether something's going to be cached, we can put all that stuff and set that up in our HTTP request. And the server can also put these things in the response when it comes back down and specify it so the client can crack open and read that stuff, what came back from the server, and know what's in there. HTTP has all sorts of response codes that come back. The most popular one we probably have all seen before is a 404, page not found error when you're in the web browser. It's been around since, you know, the early 90s when we first started browsing back using the old, you know, Mozilla client way back in the day. 403, you know, you don't have access. Authorization denied. You don't get those things. 9 times out of 10, when you hit a website and the website loads up, it's silent. You don't see this, but you're actually getting back a 200 code, which means okay, it was successful. Everything worked as expected. And then there's all these other error codes down there that, you know, and then there's even more that I don't have listed on the screen, but these are some common ones. A 500 error typically means something went wrong on the server. And we see this a lot when you're doing Silverlight programming. We had a great session that I did one of the earlier events with Silverlight where you actually look at those status codes in the Silverlight client and you can read them back and get access to those. When we're doing RESTful programming, in terms of error handling and being specific on the wire, we have API access to set all these things up on the server when we're sending a response back down to the client. And on the client side, we pay attention to these codes to take actions and determine what we're going to do in our code if something failed or something was successful. So we can use these things natively over the wire back and forth. Now, I talked about, because REST is not a specification, it's not an API, it's not a library, different people mean different things when they say REST. So there's this kind of like this sliding scale of folks who are purists and like, well, you're not doing REST if you're not using all the verbs. You know, if you're going to do an update operation, you better be using the HTTP update verb versus if you're doing a, you know, post for a lot of things. Think about when we do a regular ASP.NET website. Most of ASP.NET, especially with web forms, you're continuously doing a post back to the same page, and then you have logic on the server that receives it. What you're doing on the wire is you are overloading the post verb on that page. So whether you're doing an update, a delete, a read, or whatever, you're always just doing a post. And then the server's got some code to parse open the request to determine, you know, what are we really doing here. So it's abstracted. You know, that might not be considered by someone to be truly RESTful if we were going to expose an API like that. So there are certain things that you're going to see today in terms of the Microsoft AJAX library that when you use our AJAX library, we're going to still do the, we're going to overload the post verb and implement all the operations that way. It makes it really easy to use for us as coders because we don't have to think about this stuff, but you can also go the other route and really control things and say, I want to use all the verbs to do the specific operations and write the code and implement it the way I want. I get total control over the wire how things go. Now, another reason why, let's see what we got here for a second. Let's go on here.
Peter?
Yeah, question?
Question here that may be worth it. That may be worth you answering instead of me.
Sure.
Tasia is asking, is REST architecture style only for web applications? And from a WCF perspective, I don't know how to answer that, but I figured you, since you're in the middle of this.
So the question is REST for only web applications? No, it's not for only web applications, although 9 times out of 10, I'd say it's probably mostly used in web applications.
Or applications that are typically exposed on the web. I mean, Twitter and Bing come as
an example. So like I say, when we say a web application, it depends what your definition of web application is. Public internet-facing web services frequently these days use REST, more so than they use SOAP and WSDL. And there's a lot of reasons, and we're going to talk about those right now. But so your client doesn't have to be a web browser. It could be, you know, let's say the I think Twitter's becoming the new Northwind database, right, for sample apps. A lot of people, I asked how many people here do use Twitter? Okay, so maybe like 20% of the room. The number goes up every now and then. A lot of people say, what's Twitter? But a lot of people build demo apps using Twitter because it's so easy to use with the REST API. So I might have a Twitter client. It might be, you know, a web form app on my desktop. It might be a WPF or a Silverlight app. It doesn't have to be a web browser or a web application per se to consume those services. And the same thing like when I talked about Azure. You know, a lot of apps are going to use REST, not just necessarily a web application. All right, but why? Why is REST important? Oh, cool. Question?
For previous slides, it's POX okay, but POX.
Good question. So the question is, in the lower right of the slide, it said POX is okay. So POX stands for plain old XML. So let's come back to that with that, why that's okay and what that means there. So, yeah, a lot of stuff going by there. So all morning we talked about WCF in terms of the context of using SOAP and WSDL. Well, what about SOAP? You know, why do we have to care about REST? You know, SOAP sounds like it was great. What?
No, it was great.
Oh. Well, Miguel's been ranting and raving about it all morning. Well, under the covers, he's using SOAP.
It, for the record, everything that I did today was soap based.
It was soap based, everything he's done so far.
And yes, soap is great.
Soap is great. Soap does a lot. It does a lot of good things, but it's got some problems with it. You know, one of the benefits of soap is it's all standard-based. There's WS Star specifications. Sometimes people call them the WS Death Star specifications because they can be complex. And it's basically, soap is this whole XML model of how you define the XML message that goes over the wire. And using the headers, you can put in things like certificates and security things and transactional things. And it's great. And as you saw through Miguel's demos all morning, for us in this room as .NET developers, it's brain dead easy because the tooling takes care of all that for us. We don't ever look at that XML or see what that soap looks like. That's all in the auto-generated proxy. It works great. But if you're not a .NET developer and you're on other platforms, you have to do a lot of that stuff by hand. Or, I should take that back. These days, a lot of other platforms do have tools to handle SOAP and WSDL, but it wasn't always that way. And if you think back, SOAP and WSDL and all that type of good stuff has been baked into .NET since 1.0 with the old ASMX web services, where it's always been easy for .NET developers, but a lot more complex and harder to deal with and consume from other platforms. And that's one reason why, you know, if you don't need all this other stuff, you look at SOAP and say, why would I need this to do a hello world or pass some simple, small piece of data back and forth? It's a lot of overhead going back and forth. And that's why REST has become more popular on the Internet. Now, if you're in-house, enterprise, and you're doing stuff, maybe you have .NET talking to Java, and you need all this complex high fidelity, SOAP makes perfect sense, and by all means, use it. It's been great, and it used to be hard to get .NET to talk to non-.NET platforms in the interop space, but that's gone way better. It's a check in the box pretty much now, depending on which Java-based system you're going from, if you're on the back end that way. But again, with some of the other web-based platforms, it's much more of a challenge.
Peter?
Yes.
Well, then this question, it just disappeared, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I think it's a good question and relative to what you're talking about. Can you use transactions and security with REST? And I know security, yes, but I'm not 100% sure on the transactions. Can you shed light on that?
Yes.
Are all the transaction stuff that I taught today, is that applicable?
No. I'm going to come back to that. So essentially you have security, but you don't have transactions, right?
Ah.
Yeah. But there's a reason for that, because if you're saying, oh, no transactions, well, then this stuff isn't for you. It's as easy as that, pretty much. Because this is designed for a simpler type of scenario. So we want to break things down and make it simpler for folks to talk to. So here we go, the deficiencies in SOAP. So we need a natural way to model the resources. We want to be able to talk back and forth. I talked about interoperability as a challenge over the Internet. Well, it's kind of weird because all morning we've mentioned that, you know, WCF and SOAP and WSDL makes interop possible, that we can talk to other platforms at high infidelity. I mean, high fidelity, excuse me. Not the other way around. Yeah. Whoops. Anyway. And that does work great. But for, like, you know, let's say I was writing a web application in PHP, all right, and I had to consume a SOAP web service. They've got SOAP APIs available to consume it, but it's not as natural. It's not as inherent. The developer has to go out of their way to set those things up, and they have to actually, sometimes the tools don't work, and you have to fidget around with the XML and the SOAP that's being generated, and it makes it harder. And a lot of developers on non-Microsoft platforms, therefore, have stayed away from it. So interoperability has been a challenge on the Internet, not necessarily behind the firewall where we're all doing .NET to .NET or .NET to Java, you know, where these things have been worked out together. So that's been a challenge there. WS Death Star has become really complex, which is good if you need that complexity. But if you don't, why do you need all that extra complexity? Maybe you can get by with something simpler. And let's just leverage what's already out there on the web that's been working since the web's been around, all those HTTP verbs. So REST is going to help by getting us easier reach, by keeping it simple. Becomes more easy to interoperate with. You know, people don't have to add or deal with all the complexity. They just make the calls. It's lightweight. You're going to see in a little bit the messages that go over the wire are a lot smaller because you're just sending the data. That's it, pretty much, nothing else. And in theory, because it's more lightweight, you know, you can scale it better. You can cache GET requests because GETs are usually read-only. They're not going to change. You can cache some of that data based on what it needs to do. And again, because you don't have to do all this XML munging back and forth, it's a lot less work, especially on the client side, depending on who's the consumer of your service on other platforms. And the other easy thing is everything is addressable via URI. I don't have to have a contract. I don't have to have proxy classes. I can just say I'm going to go in the browser and type in the URL of, you know, a method on your service and get back the response. It's that easy. It's really, there's nothing hidden there. Now, if we do all this stuff, we're making some trade-offs here. And this comes back to the whole, as someone asked earlier, what about transactions? What about security? Well, the first thing was there's no metadata. You don't get a WSDL file. The nice thing about a regular WCF web service is, you know, you can go to Visual Studio, right-click, add service reference, then put in the URL of the web service, and Studio sucks in the WSDL and automatically spits out a proxy class that you call as if it was a regular local class, and you don't even know that you're going remote over the web, because as a developer, it seems easy. And I'm all, my proxy class is generated because of the contract laid out in the WSDL file. Well, with REST, there's no contract. Anyone want to take a guess what the contract is in a RESTful service? It's a document, a Word doc, printed text, a PDF. It's the developer of that service saying, here's my service, this is what it does, trust what I say. There's no technical metadata contract or specification. I just say, look, here, if you call this URL XYZ with these parameters stuck on the end, trust me, you're going to get back this type of data. And it's kind of just trust what's going to come back over the wire. That's how it works at the end of the day. It's as simple as it can be. We don't have message level security, so there's no WS security to do certs and stuff like that over the wire. However,
No certificates.
Well, maybe, right? Not at the message level, but you can use SSL. So using HTTPS and secure sockets, obviously you can point to point from the client to the web server that's processing that message. But you're not going to be able to encrypt that message on a message level, then send it off to some other server somewhere during the line. It's just point-to-point security that you have. And for that, you get all the standard security features within IIS for managing that stuff, whether you're using integrated security or Active Directory or forms authentication. You get all that type of stuff. You don't get all this stuff. You don't get transactions. You don't get reliable messaging. And if you're building a RESTful service, it's probably because you don't need this stuff. If you need this stuff, then REST is not the way you want to go. And like I said, there's no standard for describing the service. It's just you and a document between you and the end user. And we'll talk a little bit. Microsoft put some tools together that help out with that process. Miguel's actually going to have a demo of that later in the day in his last session. And you know, there's another thing here that might be a disadvantage is when you're doing a RESTful request, especially GET operation, it might not be suitable for bringing back large amounts of data. But then again, over the web, bringing back a large amount of data in any one request probably is not a good idea in general. You know, you always want to chunk it up or design your services to not send you back, you know, a 20 gigabyte file in a GET request.
It applies for a page.
Yes, for web page too. So that's general stuff here. This is what it all comes down to at the end of the day. Here's the simplicity aspect. So this is a request to a service where we want to request to get a contact and a contact ID of 1. So for those in the room there, you can see all the way down in the SO message, about the fourth line from the bottom, it says in the XML, contact ID, and then there's a 1 in the slide right there. All right. So we're basically calling a get contacts method. We're hoping to get back a list of contacts, except we want to get back a contact with the ID of 1 that we're making a request from the server. So we have to send all that XML over the wire, generate that whole message body, versus in the yellow, it might be harder to see for the folks in the room here online, hopefully you can see it a little better, we basically do a GET request, you know, whatever, mysite.com on the URL, /contact service/getcontact/1. That's it. And we're going to get back the same result as if we did that SOAP message, except we don't have all that extra stuff. Think about if you're writing JavaScript code. These days, you know, rich internet applications, AJAX, how many people are doing AJAX development of some sort, whether they're using jQuery or any custom JavaScript? Yeah, a lot of folks. This is a very common design pattern. And in JavaScript, you certainly don't want to be generating all this SOAP business in JavaScript. It would be a nightmare. And just think of performance-wise, how that code is going to run on the client side in a web browser. It would be really just a painful thing there. So that built the wrong way. But So, you know, there's back and forth where you need soap or rasp. To me, it comes down to it depends on what you're doing. If you don't need all the complexity, go simple, go rasp. So Don Box, while they were building .NET 3.5 and the next version WCS, said, you know, hey, we might as well just add rasp and not get involved in the battle over which one is better. Because the beauty of WCF is that because it's extensible, they were able to do that. It wasn't a technical challenge. We just basically added it on, and it works pretty well from that perspective. So at the end of the day, if people are wondering, you know, what's better, SOAP or REST, you know, they're kind of frenemies. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, they get along and they compliment. Use whichever one makes sense for you. We're not going to get involved in the battle. We just want to make sure we service everyone who uses WCF. All right, so I talked about we added WCF, we added REST in .NET 3.5, and we added a couple of new features to it in 4.0, which Miguel is going to go into in the afternoon. Most of the stuff I'm going to show you today is all based on what you can do in .NET 3.5. So almost everything I'm going to show you, you can do in Visual Studio 2008. I'm not taking advantage of anything specific in 2010, although there are some newer features, again, Miguel is going to mention at the end. But we essentially added this new DLL, system.servicemodel.web, and that brings all the RESTful stuff into WCF. So let's start looking at this. We're going to show you some code samples on the screen, then we're going to go into code demos and build it out. So at the simplest level, how do I get REST in my WCF service? So let's say you have a service just like you built in the morning with Miguel. You go to the config file, and Miguel talked about the ABCs of configuration. You have an address, a binding, and a contract. Contract basically maps you to the .NET class that you're going to be invoking or the interface that you're going to be calling on, the address of the URL where your service is located. The binding is all about what protocol we're going to use over the wire and what format, how we're going to encode the message. So RESTful WCF is essentially a new binding called called Web HTTP binding. And you get a new behavior called the web behavior that you have to add in there, web HTTP. So those two parts that are highlighted in bold there on the screen are basically what you have to add to your config file if you're just doing ground up REST on your own, customized. There are a couple of templates in Visual Studio that will automatically set up the configuration for you to support certain scenarios. Because there are two different scenarios at minimum that we're going to demo today and talk about the differences between them. But at the most basic level, it's just adding that binding, and most part, you're good to go. There's some other things you need to do also.
Can I just point one thing out, that so in case anybody's confused over it, this is something I didn't cover before. This is an endpoint behavior. So the behavior setup is exactly the same, but notice instead of saying service behaviors, it says endpoint behaviors, and the behavior configuration equals is not done at the service but at the endpoint level. In fact, are you missing? I think you're missing configuration there. You should say behavior configuration.
Might be. I don't know.
Yep. But it's at the endpoint level as opposed to the service one that you guys saw in the last session.
Good point. All right. So I said there's no message level security, but of course you can lock it down. You know, turn on HTTPFS, SSL. This is an example of how you would set that up in the config. I wouldn't get so hung up on the syntax right now. My point is just to tell you that you can do it. I want to move on and show you the coding aspects. I think that's what's more important as we go along here. Now, in code, if you didn't want to set up a configuration, you wanted to set up in code, you could do it manually in the code on the fly. So here's an example of creating a new service host object. You create the endpoint, and you basically just declare the behavior and the binding in the code there like that if you want to set up and do host.open. And that kind of is a scenario I think you showed before. You had a console app that basically fired up the WCF service if you're not hosting it within IIS. Although, again, you're not going to probably do that in the real world too often from that perspective. So before we talked about there's four tenets of REST, so here's the first one. How do we handle the tenet of embracing the URI as being the core piece of functionality, how we get at it? So in WCF, we have this notion of a URI template, which is basically... how many folks here have looked at the MVC framework for ASP.NET? Okay, a good number of folks, but not everyone. In MVC, they introduced a routing framework, which basically says when you look at the URL in the web browser and it gets handled at the server, that's not a path to a file or something. It's a pattern that the server is going to have to investigate that pattern and match it and then figure out what to call, what to invoke based on what it saw in the URL. So WCF is doing something similar here with this notion of URI templates. And what it is on a specific method, an operation contract, something you're exposing publicly via WCF service, you have to specify a URL template that it's going to match, so that when someone types in this URL, it's going to get routed to your method on your service. You have to set that up. So, and here you can see, we assume before, so we've created a new template. This is in code. We're going to obviously do this in configuration too. mysite.com/session/, and then this notion of using curly brackets as placeholders so you can pass in parameters. Now, the parameters obviously have to be URL friendly, so mostly we're talking about strings that we're going to pass in. And then those can be passed into the parameters on your actual methods in your service contract. So let's say we wanted to, just navigate in the web browser to, the session for Scranton 1108 on IE8 as a session name there. That's what I could enter in on the URL, and I should expect to get back the data regarding that particular session. Now, the way we're really going to do this for the most part is through attributes. That's what most of the demos are going to be today. So let's say here I have a specific method. It's in my contract. This is a getAlbum method, and it takes two parameters, an event and a title. Instead of having to write anything in code, I would mark that up with an extra attribute that specifies the URL template that I want to match to it. And that's how I'm going to get routed to this method if someone invokes that on the URL of my service. And then the event and title, whatever is passed in on that part of the URL, will get mapped into the input parameters for that method. And then the method executes and everything works the way you'd expect it to. Now, another aspect of that is that this works with the stuff you already have. So I talked about you have to be HTTP friendly, so it has to be pretty much strings that come in on the parameters. But if you had an existing WCF service, you mark it up with these attributes and you enable that endpoint and you're pretty much good to go. You can just add this on and have this working, with an existing service. So it's pretty well for that point there. The only thing is, though, by putting the attribute up there, you are marking your code up. That makes it slightly different from a code change perspective. I know Miguel talked about not all services. You can't just go into config and say, I want to change from, you can go into config and change from, let's say, SOAP and WSDL to NetTCP binary or something like that. But if you're going to switch to MSMQ, there's a fundamental difference in how you write that code because you're talking about an asynchronously designed service. With the RESTful stuff, for the most part, you can additively add URI templates and expose it like this. But if you then start using some of the other RESTful things that I'm going to show you, you can't do that. Then you have to kind of have separate service contracts that you have to expose, especially when you're supporting some of the AJAX clients. Any questions? If it doesn't have
metadata.
Oh, okay. So the question is, the session parameter that's up there on there, what am I talking about since there's no metadata? That's actually not, that just happens to be a URL I want to match because the demo I'm going to talk about happens to be about conference scheduling and looking up sessions that you would see at a conference. So actually maybe it might not be a good word for the example. So it has nothing to do with session state or anything like that. We're just talking about, conference sessions. I might attend a class. This is the REST session. Later on, Miguel's going to do what's new in WCF4 session. So that using it in that context. REST cannot handle sessions. I don't know.
That's to my knowledge. No.
No. You can cache results, but you're not doing session-based programming because this is all stateless by design. That's the whole notion of REST anyway. You would kind of be breaking the tenet of REST as a principle by having something with session. It's all supposed to be stateless. Yep.
Who was determining album there in that operation contract? If you are not adding anything on the client side, how would the client own the object album?
Good question. So here's the question. The question is, in the sample up on the screen, I have a method called getAlbum, which returns an object of type album. And let's assume somewhere else I've got an album class defined. If there's no metadata or contract, how would the client know what an album is when it gets back the result? All right, so we're going to look at that when we go into the code demo. But in short, album is defined with a data contract, the same way Miguel defined data contracts earlier. And that data contract enables that album object to be serialized into XML. And now, because of the new REST functionality, alternatively, that album object can be serialized into the JSON format. The client does not have metadata, so it does not inherently know what the album class is on the client. So there's two ways to handle that. If you're getting back JSON data and your client happens to be JavaScript, it's a dynamic language. It doesn't need to know the type. It just takes that chunk of JSON it gets back, and it can work with it. It can call, you know, .name, .event, or excuse me, it can call .title or .event on that object, and it would just work. If it is a statically typed, if you have a .NET client, you would have to have, and you'd have to do this manually, you would have to create a C-sharp class that matches the schema of that data contract that came back, of that album object. So we'll talk a little bit about some techniques for how we can do that as we go along. But good question there. All right. Tenet 2, gets are special. So you saw the web get attribute, and that's where we pass in the URI template. It kind of has its own attribute, but there's alternatively another attribute known as web invoke. So web get will always say that this, you know, if I put a web get attribute on my method, on my operational contract, I'm saying you can call this with a get request. And the assumption is a get request is always read only. It's not going to change data. It's not going to modify anything. It's always going to just read data. But if I want to use the other verbs, post, put, delete, all those things, I need to use the web invoke attribute, and then I specify the verb as a parameter and change that. And that I can use any method there to pass that in from that perspective. So here's an example on the syntax line here. So for the, I have a get contact method with a template of contact slash contact ID, and it's using a web get attribute there. Now I have a delete contact method that also takes a parameter of contact ID, but I'm using a web invoke method, and that has two parameters on the web invoke attribute. I have to specify the verb, which happens to be the delete verb, so that means this can only be called over HTTP delete, and I have a URI template. What you might notice is that the template is the same for the get contact as it is for the delete contact. It's the same exact URL. Wait a second, I just overloaded the URL. How does it sort it all out? WCF is sorting it out based on the HTTP verb that was used when the request is made. So the delete contact will only be called if the request is coming in as an HTTP delete operation. If it comes as an HTTP get, it's going to resolve that and direct you to the get contact method instead. So that's how WCF handles it on the wire. Question over here? Say it again? So the question is web get attribute a shortcut versus doing web invoke with methods that equal to get? I suppose you could look at it that way, yeah. So technically it would be. So you could do a web invoke with method equals get, but we created the web get attribute because get is what most people use for 90% of the operations, and it's a special case. That's why they wanted to have that separate in the API that way. It would have whatever the standard limitation is of a get request. So if that's what it is, that would be there. It depends on the browser, whatever you're coming across the wire as. Perfect. Sure, Miguel's question.
So if you wanted to test this URL browser,
yeah, so Miguel's question is, if I hit that URL, contact, and I pass an ID on it in the browser, I'm going to get the get contact because by the default, the browser is doing a get request. Yes, I'm going to show you that in the demo. And you actually cannot hit the delete contact method from a browser because browsers don't issue. They only do gets and posts from that perspective. All right, so let's just move along here a little bit more quickly here. So there's the object model type. So on the server side, in that web invoke, I can actually set up more than just the URI template in the method. I can actually set up what response type, what's the format of the message. So in WCF, typically you can set up, in the binding, you can set up what the data looks like over the wire as part of the binding. But you can fine-tune that in the attribute by saying whether I want the message to be XML going back or if I want it to be JSON. So I can control that as part of it. Now, there's a sample of server and client-side code here on the snippet. The client-side code there has nothing to do with WCF. This is purely just using an HTTP web request object in the .NET framework. So it's a .NET sample of consuming a RESTful service that has nothing to do with WCF. There really is little going on there. But here you can see with a client request, you manually basically set up what that request looks like. You build out the URL and you stick the data in it, and you can set the properties on it, such as the method that you're going to invoke and the content type programmatically. And when you use the HTTP web request, you can set up programmatically to call whichever verb you want, but you can't do it from a web browser. And the other thing that's important is, I talked about the tenets of REST, is being able to work with the status codes. So I don't have a sample of this, but here's a snippet on the screen. We can get access, obviously, to the HTTP context, the web context coming in across the wire, and we can set the context, set the status code on the server before it goes back. We can retrieve the context and the status code of whatever came up from the client if the client sends us one. So we've got the ability to do that all programmatically. That's how we handle the basics of REST in WCF. Any questions? Go ahead. Yes. So the question is, I mentioned that REST does not support transactions, but Azure uses REST as an API. How does it handle transactions? So Azure supports REST and SOAP. So for things that you need transactions, like if you're talking to SQL Azure, you could be going using SOAP over the wire. But for most other things, it's using REST.
Peter, can you hold on 1 second?
Sure.
It just disappeared. Todd, did you take care of that? It's losing voice? You just wiped that out? Somebody asked that in a question, just lost voice again.
If Eric's on there, he should be able to handle that in the background. I hear myself coming out of the roundtable, so I know it's going out.
I just had Eric, so go ahead and continue.
All right, so I'm in Visual Studio here, and I've got a basic project with some stuff I've set up ahead of time. And this is going to be a service around handling conference speakers. So I've got a little database here. I'm using the Entity Framework to connect to that database. And you can see here's the model here. In the database, I've got a speaker table that has speaker names. We have a list of attendees. We have some linking tables there, a speaker session table that links speakers to the sessions they're speaking at, and then a list of sessions. So that's exposed there in the model, and we can bring that back. We want to expose that to the end user. So the goal here is to create a RESTful service to expose that data. So I've got conferenceservice.cs. This is just a C# class. And what I'm about to do here is now start poking fun at Miguel and going against all the stuff he was preaching this morning. Now, I still believe in everything Miguel said, but think about this. Miguel showed you when he created a new WCF service, you have an interface that you mark up with all the service contract attributes, and then you have an implementation that's separate. And the reason for that, as a best practice, is to abstract and keep your WCF code out of your application implementation code. All right, and right now I'm about to do a demo where I'm going to completely break that, and I'm just going to put the WCF attributes directly on a C# implementation class. I don't have an interface. So, shame on me.
That's like one of the first rules I tell people not to do. What's the matter with you?
I know, I'm breaking the rules. Breaking the rules. So, there's two ways to look at this, right? And I'm going to be explicit and honest in telling you about this, right? I personally agree with the way Miguel did it. You always separate out your interface from your implementation, even when you're doing RESTful programming. But there is a notion with RESTful program, because the whole thing is we're trying to eliminate complexity, and WCF has a lot of complexity and options, which are good when you need them, but when you don't want them, because we want to keep things simple over the wire. And the thought was, you know, hey, let's just build this real quick. We don't need the interface. We'll just have the samples go like that. And when you use some of the templates in Visual Studio to create a RESTful service, a WCF RESTful service, it will not automatically create the stubs of an interface and an implementation class like it did when Miguel showed you for a regular WCF service. So I actually probably disagree with that, but that was some of the thought process behind that to keep that simple. So with that lecture out of the way, we have a conference service class, and we've got it marked up with a service contract. And the new thing that we're adding here is this other attribute on the actual class that we want to expose out called an ASP.NET compatibility requirements. And this basically links WCF into the HTTP context and all the web-based information, so we get those status codes and all the HTTP stuff coming back over the wire. It's basically enabling that and opening that up for WCF. Now, if I scroll down here, I've got some data contract classes. I have a class that represents a session, a class as part of the conference. And you can see it's marked up here with data members. Every class has a title, a description, and a session code, so we can look it up, and it's got an ID there.
So I have a quick question.
Sure.
Worthwhile. It's my understanding that attribute also ties you into IISO?
I believe that might be the case, yeah.
You can self-host HTTP, like I was doing today. I was self-hosting basic HTTP bindings. That doesn't mean that I'm going through ASP.NET pipeline, where in the case of IIS hosting, I am going through the ASP.NET pipeline, thus establishing an HTTP context, which is where this requirement comes in,
mm-hmm.
which you cannot do if you're hosting outside of IIS.
So I'm kind of statement and question in the same time here. It's my understanding that decorating with the compatibility requirements for ASP.NET does tie you into IIS. Can you confirm this, Don?
That is correct as far as I'm aware. Don confirmed that too, yeah. Yeah. So there's other options to do it, but that becomes more complex. I mean, in the case of RESTful stuff, 9 times out of 10, you will want to go through IIS because you want all the you want a web server front-ending it, because this is a web service in that sense. Whereas, a Shred WCF service, you might not always be doing web-based. If you're doing, binary TCP or NetTCP, you don't need a web server, per se. But in this scenario, doing RESTful stuff, you most likely will. So we've got a standard data contract here. I've got a collection class. I can bring back a list of those session objects. And then, hold on, and then I got a speaker class here that represents what a speaker looks like and a list of speakers. So these are things I'm going to expose back to the client. And again, this is just standard WCF. It's the same way Miguel did stuff in the morning. A question over here on the left? Order one, order equals, it has to do with, I believe it's the order things show up when you serialize it.
Yeah, it works, right?
Uh-oh.
I was wondering why you added orders myself.
Well, it was in there, actually. I got that, so. Yeah, there's a lot of options you can do on it, how you can shape the XML.
Well, in SOAP, I can tell you that in SOAP, if you leave order out, if your contract's the same on both sides, it's not going to matter, it's invisible. But as far as the physical appearance of the SOAP message as being...
The physical appearance of the SOAP message that's being built, it's going to be done in alphabetical order. So by putting order manually in here, you're manually telling it how I want this SOAP to look like, primarily in the case that it's an interoperable client that's going to be looking at your SOAP message to try to figure out how to parse it. It would make sense that it's in an order that you prefer as opposed to alphabetical order. In REST, this may actually make sense because... I'm not sure. I think that you have to control the order manually like you're doing here. If you leave order out, is the XML or JSON that's built by this service going to be done in alphabetical order or the order of declaration in the data contract? I believe it's alphabetical, which means you want the order number in there.
I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think...
It's easy enough to test, time permitting.
Another thing that you can also, I believe, specify in here is the ability if you had an optional parameter. So let's say you had where the client class did not match, you were leaving something off. He's looking it up.
I was thinking that I thought that whatever thing explaining I thought so, but I was confused by looking at the same order number 111.
Well, that part I can answer. If the order number is the same, then within that order number, it's going to be alphabetical. Within that, so now he's guaranteeing that ID comes first, and then the other ones are going to be description, session, and then title.
And so not only besides order, there are other things you could specify with the data member attribute. We're going a little bit off tangent here. But let's say I have version 1 of the service that has these four parameters, and I come out with version 2 that has another two parameters, but my clients haven't updated. I still want those clients to be able to talk to my new service. I can mark some of those up as saying, they're optional. Those are things I can do in a data contract. I'm not doing that here, but it can be done. So anyway, we're focused where I didn't want it to be. But the point... one more, and then I do want to move on. On the actual service, the ASP.NET compatibility requirements. Okay, and we're going to use that for both the plain old RESTful service and the ones that support an AJAX client too, using the Microsoft AJAX stuff. So, all right, so those are the data types. That's what we want to bring back. We want to create a class here, a method to bring some stuff back. So I'm going to do an operational contract. I'm going to do public, and I want to return a collection of sessions, and I'm going to call get all sessions. And then when I'm in here, I'm going to do sessions equals new sessions. And then I want to grab make my connection to the database and bring back the entities. And then I've got a little link query I'm going to paste in here. All right, so the important part here is just that it's going to bring back data. So I'm just going out to the data set. I'm saying bring back all the sessions that are out there. And then I'm going to add each session as it comes back into the session collection, and then I need to return the sessions object at the end there to the client. So that should send us back everything to the client. Now, the next thing I need to do is specify the URL that's going to hit this function here. So I'm going to need a web get attribute in here, and then I need to do a URI template, and I'm going to make this be /sessions. Right, and now I should be able to hit that eventually from the URL in the browser. But what I need to do is link this up and give it an endpoint on the web. So you notice over here I don't have any service files. So to expose something on the web in WCF, there's a .svc file that can link you up and be the resource that you're going to hit in IIS to get stuff. So I'm going to go ahead and add an svc file over here so that we can get at this thing. So we'll do a file. New item. Here's my. Just want to do a text file here because I'm going to set this from blank. So I'm going to call it conference service.svc. Go ahead and add that. And then we get to put an attribute in here, and I'm going to add another snippet here. And what I'm doing here is I'm using something that's known as a web service host factory. So I'm going to specify web service host factory, and I specify the service, and this is going to match back to my actual .NET class. So what I'm doing here in this SVC file is I am shortcutting some of the configuration options. So instead of going into the web.config file and setting up my ABCs, by putting this declaration in the SVC file, I can shortcut that and have it automatically generated for me by the service when it starts in the web server. So that's what we can do by having that there. And once that's there, I can right-click and say View in Web Browser. And let's see what we get here when this comes up. So I get service endpoint not found. And the reason why is I just passed in the root, but I don't have any handler within my WCF service to handle the root where someone sent something in. I'm expecting /sessions on the end of the URL. So without that, it's not going anywhere, so it's saying there's no endpoint match for that. So what we can do is let's go back over here into the code and add one. Let's go add a new method here, handler. So operational contract, we're going to do a web get again. URI template, and just take nothing on the end there, so that'll be the root, and we'll call this public, and we'll return a string, get root. All right, and now, if we save that and go ahead back out and hit it, we get back basically the XML snippet with the string in it. This is the root. So we got, because we matched the URL as being nothing after it's basically the root of the URL. It's just matching the service URL. We get back the chunk of XML. Now there's no SOAP here. There's no message body. This is just XML. The default return message format when you do this is XML. If I wanted to make a JSON, I could do that too. I could go into the web get parameter and change that over. So I can go over here and add response format equals web message format dot JSON. And now if I save that out and go hit, hit a refresh there. I gotta go recompile that again. Okay, so let's view here in the browser. Now when it comes up, I'm not getting back the XML. It actually wants to save a file type because it's sending JSON back, and by default the web browser doesn't want to display JSON because it could have something in it. So it wants you to save it as a file. So if I go, if I went ahead and hit save, let's just drop this on the desktop and call this conference-service.js. We'll save that out. And there in Notepad, we can see what we got back. It's just, this is the root. It's just pure old JSON with nothing in it there. So the data connects. So if I was making an AJAX request, I'd want to get the data back that way, less minus the angle brackets. So that is something I could do there. So let me whack that out of there and take that out because we don't need that right now. But that's a way we can send back JSON instead of XML. While we're here now, let's go look at the URL and actually put slash sessions on the end. And now we got back a list of sessions that were in the database there. Question? Yes. So the question is, how can you, when you do the URI matching, obviously something's going to go through and read through and figure out the order. So it's very similar to a try-catch block. So if you have a specific URL you need to catch, you put that first, then you put your most generic one further down in the file there from that perspective. So what I'm actually doing here by having the root up front at the top is probably the opposite of what I should be doing. I should have that further down since that's going to match the root case. Slash what?
Frog.
Well, in general, if I did slash frog, right, I don't want anyone to get anything, so I don't have to do anything. I don't have to handle it. I would just come up here, and if I type slash frog, I get endpoint not found. Oh, yeah, yeah. So I believe there is a way in the web.config, I don't have a sample, where you can redirect it to an error page, you know, to something generic that you control versus that default UI you get there. Dummy? Well, that could be any parameter then. So, yeah. You could do that, but then you need to take, you know, you would need to take a string dummy like that, and then you're, you know, yeah, you could do that if you want. I mean, there's different ways of doing it, but I believe there's a way in the config where you can actually just specify, take anything that doesn't go and send it off that way. So, that's there. Let's do something here. I'm going to go ahead and bring another snippet out here. And this is going to be to get a session by code. Oh, wait a second. Now I want to take the code that I'm going to look up on the end of the URL out there. So I can do that. And now I can do public return a specific session and get session by code. And now I'll paste my snippet in there. So here I have a slightly different set of code here. I'm basically doing a link query where I'm going to do a where and find the session based on the code that came back. Where's my... Oh, dope. Good, yeah. Group debugging always works well. Okay. So now if I go ahead and we go view this one out in the browser, I should be able to do sessions and let's say SOA 201. And now I get back just that one session. If I did session 101, I get back just session 101 there. I would get back an error. So I got an error there because I didn't handle it. So I should be handling that as a you know, it's an error handling thing inside the service. But if I don't, that's what's going to happen by default. Question in the middle there? Where? Here? It's using the type inference there at the bar. It's not because it's type inferred because I'm taking the result and I'm sticking it into a new session object right here as part of the link query. See there? That's where I declared a new session and that's what ends up getting returned back to the client. So that's what's going on.
Peter, here's a question for you, for everybody actually. Ritesh is asking how are faults handled in REST while you're on the topic of exceptions.
So good question. How are faults handled? So right now I'm not demoing any exception handling going on, so this is demo code with all the proper disclaimers applied. But if I got an exception, we don't have a SOAP message to send back. So what we send back to the client is completely up to us. There's no standards on how to handle this stuff. So what you would typically do, and this would be if you're following the RESTful guidelines, is all those HTTP codes I mentioned before, you should go into the status, the HTTP status context, and set that code. And then you can return whatever you want. You can return a string with your own error message of your own custom type. Or you could do nothing. It's completely up to you and based on the design of your service how to do it. In WCF4, and I think Miguel has a part of this, or there's a starter kit adds on, there's some sample code and some guidance around best practices for how to do that for samples there. All right, I'm going to take one more question, then I got to move on because we're short on time.
You got 4 minutes
left. Maybe more than that, but okay.
From there, how do you access the response?
Huh?
So what do you have there, how do you access the response?
Oh, within here, I just grab access to it and set it. It's in, I had it before on the slide. When I go back, I'll show it to you. There's just an object. It's web response context something. It's in the slide. We'll go back to it. I'll show it to you real quick. And then you would just set it there, and then it would be set. And then what you return would be whatever you want to return from that perspective. All right. So I do want to move on here because I want to show you guys a couple more things. So that's doing a RESTful service here. I'm going to expand out here and show you some other pre-can methods I have. This is manipulating speakers back and forth. Now, I put all the link queries in a helper class. So all the stuff I do in link, I hid that away. So basically ignore that because it's not important. But I want to point out the way these methods are defined here. So here I've got some CRUD-like operations. So I've got an add speaker method. I've got a delete speaker. I've got an update speaker. And you know, here I'm using the web invoke attribute. And for add a speaker, I'm using a post operation because when you're creating and you're doing true REST, you should be doing a post operation. That should be the only thing you use post for. Same thing when I delete a speaker, I'm going to use the delete method there from that perspective. And then so on and so forth down the line. So there's the put operation there too. All right, and parameters pass in. Now, like that sample I showed you on the PowerPoint, all these URL templates here, they all match. They're the same. The only thing that WCF is using to differentiate which one gets invoked is the HTTP verb that's called when you go in there. And then finally down here, I got a get all speakers method here. So I want to go out and hit this in the browser and then show you a couple things here. And then we've got an AJAX demo. And then we're going to try to wrap it up here as quickly as we can. I think it was speakers. There we go. So if we do speakers, we get back a list of speakers that are in the database there. Notice I got a Miguel listed down here in the bottom. Works for a really nice company called GG. I don't know what that is. Dummy data, I guess. And, of course, I can come over here and say speakers 5, and it would bring back just Miguel, because executing all that stuff there. What I'm going to do here now is fire up Fiddler. And Fiddler is a little utility from Microsoft that lets you sniff the HTTP traffic going back and forth. And let me kill Mesh because that will flood that thing up there. And here's our request builder. So I can come over here and grab URL, put in the fiddler, hit execute, and now I can get back the data that came back here. So that XML, I get a nice view here in the tool. It actually formats it for me so I could see the structure of that XML that came back. And I can also look at the request that went up over the wire. Where did it? So I can see the user agent, the host. I can see the raw result that came back. So there's the XML fully right there in Fiddler. But now if I want to do the post request, it's kind of hard to set that up in the browser. So if I want to add a new speaker, how would I do that? So I need to come over here and call speakers using a post operation. So I can do this in Fiddler. I can actually invoke all the different HTTP verbs. So down here in the request body, I'm going to add myself to the database here. So I'm going to do Control C and come in here and paste that into the body. And what I basically do there is paste in a chunk of XML that matches the schema that we're expecting for the database. No contract. Again, this is just me knowing what the schema is. I had to know this ahead of time. Paste this in there, and now I should be able to go ahead and pass this up. I believe I got to do one other thing here, which is to declare the content type is application XML. I believe that's what I need to do there. So if I hit execute on this, let's see if this works. Nope, I got back a 404 error here, so I did something wrong. Content type is probably wrong there, so let's go back to the request builder there. Let's see if I leave that out, if it'll take it. Nope. Yeah. Yeah, we're probably going to go over about 10 more minutes. All right, so we are... Well, we started 15 minutes late, though. So right now, I'm every moment from now, I'm over, because we started at 1 o'clock. We were supposed to start at 12:45, so we're okay there. Content type, maybe it's XML application. Is it application XML or XML application? I don't know what I put in there wrong. Yeah. Endpoint not found. Oh, I need an extra slash because on the match, I believe, for add speaker. No, doesn't need that. Yeah. The request builder. Oh, I had an extra slash. I need the slash off. So it's picky. Okay. So now we can see that I was added. The database generated an ID of 9 for me, and the response from adding it is basically the data that was put in. Now, if I go back to the browser, I should be able to come back in here and do a speaker 9, and I get back myself. There we go. Now, if I come back over here to the request, and let's say I'm going to do a delete. Let's delete myself. I'm going to delete speaker number 9, which would be me. And I don't need any of this stuff down here. And I should be able to execute. Got a 200 code. Nothing came back from the server. And if we go back to the browser and we refresh speaker 9, there is no speaker 9, so we get an error. And if I list out all the speakers, I'm gone, so I deleted myself. So there, that's using a fully REST style thing there and using Fiddler to change the verbs as it goes up. All right, so we've now seen how you would do the full CRUD-like operations there in REST just using WCF. All right, so I got one last demo I want to show you, and I do want to go back to the slides here for just a second so we can set this up. So you've heard me talk about, I showed you how I can return JSON data and XML. For 9 times out of 10, when you're working with REST, you're going to want to do a JSON-based return data type, because JSON is the de facto language on the web, especially when working with AJAX and JavaScript, because JavaScript just reads in the JSON, and it's an object. It can just access the properties. It doesn't have to declare anything ahead of time. It's all dynamic. If we do XML, that's fine. And the XML that I've been showing you in these samples would be, as we heard POX earlier before, plain old XML, just XML with no schema or anything like that. You notice with JSON, it's much simpler. We reduce the number of characters because we don't need all the extra angle brackets and the metadata around the data. It's just the data, name, colon, value pairs there. So we can do that. When you do REST and WCF, we have a mechanism that supports the Microsoft AJAX framework so that you can call your RESTful service from JavaScript using the Microsoft services in a way that's like invoking any .NET service, where it'll basically generate a proxy for you automatically and be able to get the code back. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to jump to a completed version of the service, so we don't have time to type out right now. And what we did here is I basically created a new SVC file. So you can go in to a project, you can say add new item, and one of the templates in there is a, where's my WCF? That's disappeared. Don't know where I went there. But anyway, one of the options is a template says you can add an AJAX-enabled WCF service. And what it would do is it'll add a new SVC file.
Hey, Peter, yep. Share the
code. Huh? Oh. Yeah, good point. Easy to forget that, going back and forth there. So sure. Let me go back to my original project here. And
I'm getting bombarded here.
Well, it happened a couple times when you were doing it, so I got your back. All right, so there we go. I don't know why the other one didn't have that there. So there's AJAX-enabled web service. So if I create that, and let's just call this conference service JSON, it creates the SVC with a code behind file for it, and it basically sets us up with the attributes here and, you know, a little hello world method there. Now note, again, unlike the other AJAX service, it doesn't do the separate interface and implementation for you. It just sets you up with a class. Bad practice in my opinion, but, you know, trying to keep things simple, that's the way it's setting it up there.
Not only that, it's putting it as part of the host project. Oh,
yeah. So another reason why you should always know your tools and not always do everything the tool does by default and step out of the line. So that's what it does and creates for us, and it sets up all the configuration for us there in the SVC file. So now let me jump over to the completed version here. And what we basically did here is I copied over all the code for all those speaker methods, for all the CRUD methods, and just pasted them into the service here. So I've got my add speaker method, delete speaker. But what you'll note here is that for all the web invoke methods, they all say post, because I'm overloading the post verb here. And you'll also notice I removed all the URI templates. I'm not matching URLs. So what's going to happen now is when we want to expose the service using this functionality that we've added to support an AJAX client, we're not using URLs where you customize the URLs. We're just saying you're going to hit the SVC file using a proxy class we're going to generate for you automatically. And then, of course, it'll do the work. The proxy class will redirect it to which one of these methods needs to get called. So if I go over here and we view this guy in the browser, I got to shut down the web server on the other one.
Not 100% sure on if you got that compatibility requirement, but for this problem. Have run into problems before. Are you aware of any?
No, but I had 2 instances going. That's why it blocked. So I had to stop it. So here I'm hitting the SVC file for that new service, and I get, you know, the default metadata thing set up there. But if I put a /js on the end of this and I hit enter, I'm getting back a little JavaScript file. All right, and of course if I save this thing out, and let's save it to the desktop, and we'll call this our proxy.js, I'll save it down there to the desktop. And if we go over here and open this guy up. I get a bunch of JavaScript in here. Now, of course, this is big, long, and bulky, but what this essentially is a proxy class that lets us call that this service from JavaScript on the client just by issuing /js on the end here. And what we can do here now is I've got a regular ASPX page here. It's got a little form on it where I can interact with the speakers. Let's view this in the browser. All right, so just I can type in some data to add a speaker, and I can say get all speakers there. Let's go back and look at the code on that. And using the ASP AJAX framework, we have a script manager tag on the page, and this will let us pull in external scripts. So I can add a service reference, and I point it at the URL back to my WCF AJAX-enabled service. This is very similar to if I wanted to do a just put a script tag with a source property equals that SVC file. I could have done that too. There's some additional benefits you get by using the ASP colon web control here, where it'll bring in some of the IntelliSense for you into Visual Studio. So that's why we're doing that. And then if we look down here on the Get All Speakers button, I have a little JavaScript handler set up that calls a JavaScript Get Speakers method. And up here on the page, I've got a bunch of JavaScript code. So here's a Get Speakers method. And you'll notice in here, I basically call conference-service-json.getAllSpeakers as if that were some local .NET class. But this is JavaScript. And I just have to type that, and that's all it works. And if I go down here, you'll see that I actually get IntelliSense on it. So this is in Visual Studio. I can see, you know, here's add speaker, delete speaker. I got get all speakers. And I'm getting full IntelliSense here on what I can do with this thing. So this is all in the browser, and it's getting the IntelliSense off of the JavaScript proxy that our server generated and brought it in. Of course, I have to wire it up with a callback method, because when you're doing JavaScript, it's asynchronously. And when I get to the get all done method, I basically take the results I got back from the server, which is that big chunk of JSON data, and I'm going to go ahead and add speaker, and that calls another JavaScript method, which is going to go ahead and essentially go into the document and insert a bunch of list elements for each speaker. All right, so now if I go to the browser and hit the button, it goes out and brings all the speakers back from the database there and inserts that. What I really want to do here is run Fiddler. Let's refresh this page. Oh, wait a second. That's not what I wanted to do here. Hold on. I have another little utility here. This is the web developer helper that you can download, and it will log all the HTTP traffic back and forth. So here we can see all the things that went over the wire. One of the things I want to point out here is there's a request to the SVC file with a /js debug. I did a /js when I brought the JavaScript down in the web browser. If you do /js debug, it brings the JavaScript down with a bunch of XML comments in it so that you can view it, and that gives you the IntelliSense. So if I look at the response on that one there, let me bring this up and make this a little bigger. You'll see the only difference here, it's the same JavaScript code, but I have all these comments here that define the JavaScript IntelliSense on that method. And if I call get all speakers, now I can see the request. There's the request by. There's nothing in it. And I can see the response that came back. It's the JSON data right there. Comes back, all the elements there. And then that's what's getting iterated by the JavaScript inserted into the page. So now, without any code changes on the server, again, our server-side code is the same code here, and I don't have to have the URL templates because the JavaScript proxy is always posting back or making a request of conference service json.svc. It gets redirected because the proxy service tells it what to do. It's serializing the speaker object into JSON for me. It handles that. And my client-side proxy pushes the JSON back up because that's the native format. I don't have to do any transformation on the client. So it's a nice little feature to use RESTful WCF with an AJAX client there. This works only with the Microsoft AJAX library. If you're using another AJAX library to talk to a web service, you would go back and do it the same way I was doing with the previous version, except instead of using XML, you can just say, I want the message format to be JSON, like I did with that earlier example, and you can just call it raw. But what this does is it overloads the posts, so it's not a pure REST, still RESTful though, and makes it easier for us as developers. I get this proxy class, I get IntelliSense down in my ASPX file, and I can write JavaScript and get all this functionality there in the IDE. So it helps speed it up and make it really easy for me. All right, let me go back to the PowerPoint, and we're going to wrap up now because we're over by 15 minutes, and I'm about done. So just a couple closing comments here. And I'll take questions once I get off stage. You guys can talk to me. Talked about that already. One other thing I'm not going to demo today, but WCF REST also supports syndication. So I could take the data that came back from the conference schedule and expose it as a Atom feed or an RSS feed that could be consumed as a blog software or, you know, in an RSS reader. So that's another option. And the difference there is basically you use a different URI template and you feed the data into a syndication object and it'll send it back to the client.
Can I answered a question earlier when somebody asked if WCF supports Atom format, and my reply was no. Right now, sadly, it's XML and JSON. Atom is not part of the list. But in what way? Because I didn't want to give the guy bad information. That's why I interrupted you. In the response and request format, you only have the option to expose or consume XML or JSON. Right now, it's the only thing in the enum list. So how are you adding Atom technology into this? You may want to detail on that to make sure that the guy understands that I asked the question earlier.
Okay, so the question is around the syndication and how we can handle Atom and feeds. And unfortunately, because we're out of time, I don't have time to go into it. That could be the whole another 15 minutes. We could talk about that. But to make it as simple as possible, so exposing your data as a feed is something you can do. There is the notion of, in WCF, a syndication feed, which is a collection of data that you want to send back to your client. All right, so when you bring the data back from the link query or from wherever your backend database is, you stick it into this feed collection. And the feed collection is what you're going to expose over the wire. Now, there's all different types of feed formats. There's probably three different versions of Atom. There's a couple of versions of RSS. And the beauty of the way they implemented it in WCF is a syndication feed in WCF as an object is abstracted from the actual format that goes over the wire. So once you put your data into a syndication feed object, you can then specify which of the Atom or RSS formats you want to send it back to the client. And that's done by setting a bunch of attributes, which if we had more time, we could show that demo, but we don't.
So you're differentiating between syndication and conventional request response formats, which is the question that I answered.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, from that perspective. All right, so just to close out here, one of the things you might note or see with RESTful stuff is that some people might say the tooling is lacking. You know, there's no add service reference. Well, that's because REST doesn't have a contract. It's just, hey, here's a document, here's how my thing works, and you have to build it. What you'll notice is I did not demonstrate to you today how to build a client, other than I briefly showed the JavaScript client there in an AJAX page. If you're going to build a client, typically, you can just use a web request object in .NET Framework without even using WCF. Now, there are ways to use WCF to build a WCF client to RESTful service, and Miguel actually has a good sample demo that he's built to consume the REST APIs from Bing Search.
I do. It's not part of today, but anybody that wants to stay afterwards and later, I'll be happy to show them.
And we'll include the link in the slide deck and post that up there. So
and Twitter.
And Twitter. So there are examples up there. But another thing to just know about, folks who consume REST, you know, non-Microsoft folks, are, you know, you note there I got a slide, a bullet that says, are tool skeptics. Because people, you know, it's very simple. Why do I need all these crazy tools? It's just a simple URL. I could just construct it on my own and consume the JSON data and move on and be done with it. So I don't need all these extra tools. And that's kind of why in that space it seems to be less important. But from that perspective, Microsoft added some tools, and here I talked about the consumption options. Really, Your options are the HTTP web request, and you can use WCF, but mostly the AJAX stuff. And then Don's also going to show with OData and ADO data services some other options for consuming a feed down on the client there.
It's not Bing Maps, it's Bing Search.
All right, well, close enough.
I got killed on that at TechEd because people were expecting Bing Maps.
All right, I'll modify that slide. So Miguel's got a sample, and when we update the slide and post all the resources, there will be a URL link in that slide that'll have that there. So in terms of tooling, there is, if you're in Studio 2008, there's this thing called the REST Starter Kit that adds some stuff that's not there in the base WCF framework. And it's basically a lot of project templates that create some of the new service types, some guidance around how you do things like error handling. And two things in the REST Starter Kit actually made it into WCF4, and that's what Miguel's going to demo later. That's going to be a talk. There's no contract, but what if we could just auto-generate the document that says, here's how my service works? You know, we can mark it up and use some metadata for that. So we've got some tooling that does that, and Miguel's going to demo that. And then there's also the ability to have some caching, to cache some of these RESTful services that we put out there. So that's what's coming up there. Here's a quick sample. I'm just going to skip over this because Miguel's going to talk about this more. This is a sample of using in the starter kit and Studio 2008 generating help. I believe it's slightly different in .4.
It looks more MSDN-like.
Yeah, when you have the actual the version there. So if you're on 2008 using .NET 3.5, definitely go get the REST starter kit. It's currently listed as a CTP preview 2. And it's one of those things that I don't think it has a well-defined roadmap, whether there's going to be an official 1.0 release or what. It's just tools that were put out. It's on CodePlex. You can use it. And a lot of the features in there, again, some of them are baked in at WCF4, and they're just there. You don't need them, per se. So I have a couple of resources here, which will be in the slide deck for when you download later on. And with that, we will conclude the REST service. I will be hanging out up front to answer questions. But we're going to take a 15-minute break. And then Don is going to come up and go on to the next session.
I got to say real quick, I put a shout-out earlier to the 100-plus attendees that are remote to send me an email telling me where in the world they are. I'm just curious as to where people are listening. And I got to give kudos to this guy, Coral Scott, who is listening to us from Southern Australia, where it happens to be, well, when this email, it was 2:48 a.m., which is late. And this was, you know, a few minutes ago, so... This guy is up in the middle of the night to listen to this stuff, so we certainly appreciate it, man.
All right, so we will pick up at approximately 10 of, a little after quarter of.